morning. This is the Subcommittee on Human Services. We're going to take public testimony today in self-sufficiency, child welfare, and it's House Bill 5026. And would you like to lead us through this a little bit?
As the co-chair just said, today has been set aside for public testimony on a portion, some of the DHS programs we didn't hear from the public on previously.
So the way we're going to do this is we're going to call you up in groups of three. I hope you all get along with each other in groups of three. And each of you will have 3 minutes to speak. You'll have a little number here you'll see coming up when you speak. And if you go over 3 minutes, there's a button she'll hit, and you'll drop down to the basement. We'll try to be lenient, but try to wrap it in 3 minutes, because we want to have everybody have a chance to speak, and we want to hear everybody's testimony. We don't want to be in a situation where people are leaving at the end of the hour and a half, and we're running out of time. So what we'll do is run that way, 3 minutes, and I think it'll work really well. So I'm going to start calling up. I'll call three names, and then I'll tell people who's on deck so they can get ready to come up, too. So John Mullen, Carrie Stepsenik, I'm probably doing this wrong, and Sybil Hebb. Please introduce yourselves to the committee and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I have plenty of colleagues that are going to testify on self-sufficiency. I'll just say that I'm with them and support their testimony. But I'm here today to talk about program design. The discussion that went on was really insightful with the committee. I just want to point out a couple of things. When in 2009, I was co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, and we raised concern about the split between DHS and OHA, with OHA being created. We were worried about what was going to happen with clients and the services that they needed. This led to a stakeholder group, which I participated in, that looked at shared services and services that would remain in OHA and DHS. It was a good process. We had a lot of really very good discussion. One recommendation that came out of it was to continue a different kind of stakeholder group that would look at the relationship between OHA and DHS and offer advice and bring in people to have discussion on a variety of issues. We talked about everything ranging from domestic violence to fraud investigation to a variety of ways in which eligibility and modernization was supposed to work. This committee is all too aware of what happened with the technology breakdown, not only with Cover Oregon, but also putting modernization on the back burner. What we wind up having is a system that is no longer unified in terms of the local community. People go to the DHS offices for some things. They call into the processing center for their medical services. It's my hope that we will eventually see a way to reunify services that are client-based at the local level. I do think that our stakeholder group that we have now, I'm currently the chair of it, representing the Human Services Coalition, is about to come to an end. I do think that this is an important thing going forward, and I may ask you for a budget note around this issue so that we have further stakeholder involvement on the issues relating to clients served in both departments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson and committee members. My name is Carrie Stepnik. I work for Child Welfare. I've been in that position for 5 years now. I actually was here 2 years ago testifying in front of you guys in regards to workload issues, but today I want to talk about what I do in my job, and my number one priority in my job is child safety and making sure that the children of Oregon are safe. The second responsibility I have is reunifying families and making sure that these children are able to go home to their families and be with their families. I work with families that are struggling with addiction, severe mental health issues, child abuse, child neglect, sexual abuse, teens that are on permanent foster care. That's the main groups that I work with. And a lot of them come from low-income families, low education. Most don't work at all, don't have the skills to, obtain jobs or maintain them once they get them. And many of the families I work with are multi-generational in the system. And what I mean by that is the parents that I'm working with today were in the system as kids themselves, and the grandparents were in the system as kids themselves. The decisions that you make here at the Capitol affect the work that I do every day. And the main reason I'm here is to talk about how it affects myself and my colleagues in worker safety issues. And, you know, we work with families that are in crisis. They're at that lowest rung of desperation. And, you know, most of the time they're either high or suffering from severe mental illness. And, you know, we go into their homes. We are always by ourselves as workers. We don't go as two people together. That it's just not feasible for us to do that financially for the agency. And, you know, we've seen an increase in the number of child welfare workers being harassed. And I personally have had a situation where I had a client who figured out which vehicle was mine. And I'm usually the last one out of the office at night and was sitting at my driver's door waiting for me. And it was a little unnerving, to say the least. So what I want you to focus on is the House Bill 3391. That's coming up in regards to DHS child welfare worker safety issues. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd just like to take a moment to thank Ms. Stefnik and all of her colleagues in child welfare for doing incredibly important and incredibly difficult work, and having skilled professionals such as yourself who are really committed to helping our families in the state where they are in crisis and helping try to break this multi-generational cycle. You're on the front line, big time.
Absolutely.
And without people like you, Oregon's children would really not have the kind of advocates and protectors that they deserve and need. So thank you very much.
Other questions? I want to know more about this just for a few moments. How often do you feel like you're in danger because of the families you're dealing with?
In 5 years, I can count on one hand the number of clients that I've had physically get in my face, screaming, yelling, completely out of their mind, hopped up on meth, and whatever other drugs they happen to take. I've physically had a client grab me by the wrist, and I was able to defuse that situation. Just because of my experience, my background is juvenile corrections and adult corrections, so I have a little bit more skill in that manner.
I remember that.
But I've dealt with that kind of situation. And, you know, going into these homes, you don't know who's hiding in the closet. You don't know who is down the hallway, you know, and they know they're not supposed to be there. Especially when you have a mom that you've returned a child to and the dad's not allowed to be there because of a domestic violence situation, and, you know, mom's letting dad come through the back door, and, you know, you never know what situation you're walking into. I have had one situation that I actually refused to go to the house by myself, and I've taken a coworker with me.
And yet those kids are left at home.
Well, according to the Oregon safety model, we have to, you know.
You're fearful of going to the home, but we'll leave the kids at the home.
Right, because of the way that our policies are written and the way our Oregon safety model is written. There's only certain reasons we can pull children out of the home.
Senator Winters?
Well, I want to know more about this and what those reasons are, because our number one priority is supposed to be the safety of children. So I need to follow up on this issue, but I'd like to know what percentage of your caseload is that you would put in these categories that you've described to us, particularly, you know, when you start talking about the potential of violence. Can you give us some idea of what that caseload, you know, out of that caseload, what we're talking about, what's the universe? And then the second question is, in the one instance you were able to take a coworker with you, what does your supervisor, what role does that supervisor play when you report back that this may be a family that you're going to and that you really do need another support and you can't go alone?
So I'm going to go backwards on your questions. We do have a system in place where we can tag our in our actual ORCID system, we can tag a family if there's a worker safety concern. Whether a worker goes in and reads that or not, like on one case in particular that I have, I'm, I believe, the third or fourth caseworker in almost 6 years. And so there is a worker safety issue attached to that. I did go in when I first took the case on and read what that worker safety issue was and, you know, made some personal determination from that point. You know, for example, last night I went to go meet with a client who has a warrant out for her arrest. She is a meth addict, and, you know, she's in a kind of a desperate situation, and I've been trying to track her down for about a week now. And finally got a hold of her, and she agreed to meet me in a park. And so I tried to get a hold of my supervisor. It was after 5 o'clock. He had already left the office and wasn't able to do that. And so I text messaged a coworker of mine and said, this is where I'm going. This is who I'm meeting. And she said, okay, let me know when you leave. Because that way at least someone knew where I was. And that's kind of the system that our, my coworkers and I, you know, I'm in a small office in a small county. And so that is something that we do amongst ourselves. And it's actually a subject that we just talked about in our morning huddle yesterday with our supervisor about kind of, you know, vetting that out a little bit more so that we do have some inner office policies to follow. But there's a lot of situations where we go out on our own. Now, to answer your first question, a normal caseload is 11 to 13 kids. 2 years ago, when I was here testifying in front of you about workload issues, I had 27 kids on my caseload at that time. At this point, I believe I'm, I just had one fall off because I finalized an adoption. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yay. So I believe I'm at 11 or 13 kids. I can't remember. I'm right at that. This is a normal caseload range right now because of the money that we were given last spring and able to hire new workers. It's made a huge difference. Thank you, by the way. I appreciate it as a worker. So almost every single one of my cases on my caseload, there's drug addiction. There's alcohol addiction. I have one particular client that is severe mental health and has been involved with the methadone treatment program for 15 years now. So, I mean, these are the type of people that I'm working with.
I've got to, you know, maybe we need to talk to...
Yeah,
I think we're getting far afield, and I want to just follow back up with Aaron and the agency to talk about systems and processes.
Can I just ask a clarifying question, though, Mr. Chair?
You can.
Thank you. It'll be really quick, I promise. I think. I'm trying to figure out how to articulate this without sounding like I'm minimizing your sense of danger, because I hear you loud and clear, right? And I'm concerned that we make sure, I mean, or that I'm minimizing the danger kids are in, right? My husband was a reserve police officer for some time, so I have some sense of what frontline people deal with. And I ask this question, like, you talk about a situation where you go into a home where there's a domestic violence thing and mom is letting dad in through the back door and you don't know if he's going to be there when you get there. And that's obviously a situation that could put you or any worker in some jeopardy. The question is, in that context, I mean, assuming that you don't think that the dad is also abusing the kids, that the kids are that their kids are involved with child welfare, because by definition, if there's domestic violence, that's a child welfare issue. I could see, and maybe this is what I'm not sure I'm right about, I could see a situation where you would have a very reasonable, rational perception of a risk, but you wouldn't think the kids were at risk. I just want to clarify that we're not. You don't think that there are situations where you think workers might be at risk, but the kids might not be at risk? Or do you think that there's never a situation where you would have a perception of risk to yourself and not think that the kids have? Am I being articulate at all?
Yeah, I actually understand exactly what you're trying to get at.
Yeah.
And there's so many variables to every single case, and every
sure.
case is different. I mean, this domestic violence case may be one way, and
right.
this domestic violence case will be another way. And it's a case-by-case basis. And it's the rapport that I feel that I build with my clients of how I determine risk.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I always keep myself on guard.
Mm-hmm.
I never put my back to an open hallway. I never go in the door and put myself in a corner to where I don't have an escape route. But just being personally aware of that kind of a area, and you know, I'm required to look in all the rooms and you know, all of that. And so I do it with caution, absolutely personal safety. And like I said, if someone's given me a you know, the weird vibe, I take someone with me.
Mr. Chair, I don't want this conversation to be that this is what child welfare looks like.
No.
So I think that we may want, I do think that we need to talk to the agency about protocols and what's in place. And I think we look at, because you said it was a small county, a small area. There's some other dynamics that happens in smaller areas and may not happen in larger ones. So I'd like to pursue this with the agency further.
I agree. And we'll take it offline to do it.
Yeah,
and we have other
you.
People want to speak today. However, in deference to the House, I know there's Representative Boone and Representative Stark want to ask a question. And then we'll get back to you offline, Carrie.
Okay.
I was just going to throw out that I agree with Senator Winters that this could be this is a bigger conversation. But volunteer firefighters get called to a call, medical call, unknown medical or whatever, and it's a known meth house or something. They always call for police backup, and they always get it before they go in. It's just the way it is. I don't know if it's a set policy or what, but it's just to prevent any other issue, and there usually isn't, but you never know. Or you say that the person may have a gun, or they're known to have guns or whatever, and so you don't go in until you get your backup. So.
Right, and like I said, I assess each case individually, and I determine what I feel the safety is before I go there. But I'm still required to go into that home every month.
That's a discussion we'll have offline.
Right.
Okay. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Bates. As I did want to chime in on this conversation and a clarification of a couple different things she just testified on, and that there's two different types of dangers that Child Protective Services will face, in that there's the initial when you are going to remove a child from the home. And you very much expect at that point a parent to be upset. I mean, it's like taking a cub from a mother bear. And just because they're hostile toward you doesn't mean that they're being hostile toward the children. I have experienced that with law enforcement and a caseworker at the airport where a father was trying to flee with his child. And you know, the behaviors of that man in those 30 minutes, completely different than his normal day-to-day respectful behaviors. So there's that type of protection. And it's Karen, right? And I apologize. And as Carrie was saying, in those situations, based off of the information they have the discretion to call in law enforcement to go with them or not. Another issue that she referenced House Bill 3391. This is the ongoing danger of what they face. So if that father or mother or whoever consistently makes threats beyond that initial intake, then the ability to protect our caseworkers from them, and House Bill 3391, I know this isn't a hearing on it, tries to work with the department to allow some of those protections. And so the system, I'm not saying that it's not couldn't use improvement, but the system is designed in a way to protect the caseworkers in these situations and allow them, you know, a lot of freedom in what they do and don't do.
Correct.
I think that's a point that Senator Winters is trying to make, too. It's not a one-size-fits-all. I appreciate that. I'm going to stop the testimony there because I'm worried about the time, but I appreciate your coming forward to this issue, and we'll be hearing a lot more about it during the session, I'm sure. Thank you.
Chair Bates, Co-Chairman Nathanson, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today to speak in support of the Human Services Self-Sufficiency and Child Welfare budgets. From the Law Center's perspective, as you all know, we work with low-income people who are struggling to overcome the barriers and burdens imposed by poverty. And in our opinion, the Department of Human Services and the programs at Self-Sufficiency and Child Welfare, they save lives on a daily basis. They make a huge difference for our clients, and they make a huge difference for children in terms of the trajectory of their lives. And so we're very grateful for that work, and we're grateful for the programs. I'm here to urge more support for two specifically critical programs that we think are very important to especially victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And as you may know, a significant number of our clients are struggling with those issues to overcome those burdens and barriers, and that makes an even greater cycle of poverty that's harder to escape. And so two programs that we think are very critical are something called the Temporary Assistance Program to Domestic Violence Survivors. I know you're familiar with that program. We're very grateful for your support of it in the past. We hope that it can be expanded. There's a bill that's been referred to you unanimously from the Senate Human Services Committee. It will be before you all for consideration down the line to expand that program. The way that program works is a survivor who's in immediate danger with her children and needs to flee so that she can get to safety, or he can get to safety, talks to a caseworker who assesses the situation and determines whether or not there's a need for immediate financial assistance to, for example, buy a bus ticket to help the family move to a safe location or spend a couple of nights in a motel where they're safe and not at risk of abuse in the home. So those programs make an incredible difference to our clients. They save lives. We'd like them to be expanded so that sexual assault survivors can be eligible as well, because sexual assault survivors fleeing with their children are in the same set of situations, and the statute doesn't right now allow them eligibility. We also hope there'll be greater financial flexibility. The other program I wanted to speak about briefly is something called the Co-Located Program, which places domestic violence advocates at child welfare offices to help caseworkers assess situations and provide victims who are parents in the child welfare system with specialized advocacy and safety planning and support so that they can resolve their safety situations and children can remain safely at home or can return home more quickly. That program's been tested in offices across the state. It's had great results, and we really hope that we'll be able to fully implement it after this session with some increased funding. So again, we really appreciate your support and attention to these issues. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to ask that we have Aaron Henkelman and Jane Downing come up, just those two. And Gary, you want to stay there for a minute? Gary? Well, never mind. Okay.
I'm sorry?
You've signed up for two different panels, right?
No.
You didn't mean to?
Okay. Sybil signed up on both.
Oh, did Sybil sign up twice? Okay. Thank you, Carrie.
Okay.
So we're still on child welfare, and then we're after these two, we're going to jump over to self-sufficiency. I thought we'd bring them up that way, so it's a little less confusing. So please introduce yourself to us.
Good morning, Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson and the Chair Committee. My name is Erin Henkelman. I'm an Assistant Program Director with Clackamas Women's Services, a nonprofit in Clackamas County serving survivors of domestic and sexual violence. I'm here this morning to talk about the significance of the co-located advocate program that we currently have in our county. I can speak on behalf of being a former child welfare worker myself, as well as holding the position of co-located advocate in my county through my current employer. I just want to talk a little bit about the benefits of the partnership that I've seen over the years. We are able to provide lots of in-depth safety planning for families experiencing domestic violence, education, advocacy, and support. Through this partnership, I feel we've seen an increase in the child welfare staff knowledge, as well as knowledge within our own agency about that system and how to support families that are accessing those programs. I would say when our funding increased to provide two full-time advocates, one at each branch, we saw a significant increase in our referrals from caseworkers and from self-sufficiency staff. We were able to engage more quickly with the families, as well as provide more wraparound services to them and provide support through the life of their case, whereas with less staff, our staff were stretched out, traveling back and forth between each of the branches and not being able to get involved with families as quickly. And I think that has a significant impact on the decisions and the options that may be presented to them. I just ask that you consider the significance of this funding, and thank you for doing that in the past and supporting our work with child welfare. And I really appreciate our partnership with child welfare and see the impact that it has for families. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Bates and Co-Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Jane Downing, and I'm the Executive Director of the Center for Hope and Safety, formerly Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service, and we provide services to victims and survivors of domestic and sexual violence in Marion County. I'm here this morning to talk to you about the value of DHS programs in partnership with nonprofit programs. It's been in my 24 years, I can say some of the programs, the TADVS and the co-located programs, have been some of the best partnership programs that I have seen in all those years. And they truly save lives. And so when you consider adding additional funding to programs like these, I want you to keep in mind that you really are making a difference. Research has shown that if you support the non-offending parent, you have better outcomes for the children. And both of these programs provide better outcomes for children in the long run. By providing advocates co-located in child welfare offices, you're building that partnership that ultimately helps those parents move on to being self-sufficient, to being able to provide support to their children, and build that relationship that in the long run is going to make them successful parents and successful in our communities. We thank you for the support that you've shown. In Marion County, we have a whole 2.7 FTE in co-located advocates. But what I can tell you is not only are we having better relationships with child welfare, we're also seeing child welfare staff come and take advantage of those co-located advocates. And so you're not only supporting victims and survivors who are seeking services, you're also supporting the staff members who are working for those organizations. So I thank you so much for your support. I hope that you are able to increase those programs because we've seen what a difference that they can make in our community. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Senator Winters.
Welcome and thank you. You recently expanded here in Marion County. Can you share with us what the private-public financial dollar contribution is?
Absolutely, Senator Winters. Thank you for your question, and thank you for your support of that project. We actually have just opened a new advocacy office just right down the street. I hope you come visit and see what we're doing there. And it was about $1.6 million project, and through community donations, foundations, and government support, we were able to pay off that building in less than 2 years. And that is because the community really cares about this issue and really has wrapped around us and helped us wrap around the folks in our community. And we're able to provide computer workstations there where folks can come and look for jobs and housing. We're able to do teen groups there. We have 3 support groups going on at the same time, all with free child care. The services have just been amazing. We've had more than 1,500 people walk through our door, 450 of those in crisis, and had a 40% increase in volunteers to our program since we opened. And we've only been open 6 months. And so we thank everyone for the support that we've seen, and we know that that's going to make a difference, and these programs are also going to make a difference. Thank you.
Just follow up, since we're talking budget, we passed 3194, and a part of that legislation included 10% of those funds, funds that we have through CJG, to go to victim services. What difference do you think that that 10% will make for you and others? And both of you can respond to that, because I think we're the only state in the U.S. that have done so.
Oh, thank you, Co-Chair. Senator Winters. The 10% is going to make a huge difference to our programs. We hope that it will be at the governor's recommended amount, because when I think about what we're going to be able to do, additional staff, PSU did a study that found that for Marion County alone, back in 2006, we should have more than 30 advocates doing crisis intervention only, not shelter, not all the other services we provide, but crisis intervention, and we have 14 advocates providing all the services in our community. And so I'm very excited about the potential for that 10% in being able to provide more advocates on the ground, providing services in our community, or whatever way that we can make that funding, that we can match it with community dollars and be able to provide even more services in our community. Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Thank you for your test. Oh, I'm sorry.
I apologize. Could you just talk briefly more about the co-location aspect a little bit? One of my interests for a long time, we passed Senate Bill 450 in 2013, Senator Winters and I were both on that task force and working on streamlining delivery of human services so that people don't spend their time going from place to place to place. And could you talk about how that's functioned and whether it feels like it's actually truly integrated or what we could be doing to help integrate service delivery a little bit better for people who need safety net services to get them back on their feet faster? Or is that somebody else could talk about better?
Sure. I could speak to it a little bit. I would say for us in Clackamas County, we have had the ability to have the advocates there as folks are seeking services with child welfare or self-sufficiency programs, whereas in the past that used to look like a warm handoff or a referral. So the advocates are actually going out in the homes on the initial assessments with the workers or participating and providing additional support during the TADVS intakes versus connecting with the families afterwards. So I think in terms of the co-location, they are then able to provide the in-depth safety planning in that moment and then connect them to other resources that may be available within the county.
Thank you.
And I would just add, the other thing that happens is very often someone will be talking in the office about domestic violence, and our co-located advocate will pop up her head and say, I can help you with that. And so right in the immediate moment that they're thinking about someone needs that help and support, there's someone right there to consult with and to get connected with that person that needs it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Thank
the program you. You're going, you're putting together. And I need to hear a little more about Marion County.
Always.
I know, you're always ready. Patty Whitney Wise, Sybil Hebb again, and Michelle Roland Schwartz. And on deck is Marie Hill, Heather Conroy, and Philip Kennedy Wong.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I may, while people are getting situated, just so the members of the subcommittee know, there are several pieces of written testimony that have been posted in OLIS for you to review as well.
Thank you.
Chair, if I may, I'll cede my time to Elizabeth Kushwa on the same issue. I signed up twice, mistakenly. Thank you.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the Director for Partners for Hunger Free Oregon, and we also staff the Oregon Hunger Task Force. We're here today in support of the self-sufficiency budget, and in particular, the services provided for families so that they can have a pathway out of poverty and into stability. We want kids to be able to do well in school and parents to be able to pursue the jobs of their dreams and have a good, stable life in the communities. As you know, our economy hasn't been working real well for a number of people with the Great Recession, and even coming out of that, times have been tough for many, many families. We're fortunate to see the numbers of TANF families going down right now as jobs begin to come back into the economy. Yet even there, many of the jobs are lower paying, and there still needs to be some support network for these families. We know that hunger results from economic instability, and that if we ever really want to eliminate hunger in Oregon, we have to provide those stable environments for families with good paying jobs so that they can provide for their families and be a member of the community more effectively. I've submitted testimony as well as a fact sheet from the TANF Alliance. We've met with most of you about the recommended increases in TANF, both within the governor's budget, which is a $30 million proposal to expand services to these families, really help strengthen those programs that help them move forward and target the families who are coming up against their five-year lifetime limit on TANF to make sure that they are successful in moving back into the workforce. We also, as a TANF Alliance, have recommended an additional $10 million in support services that we feel round out the package. And honestly, this is only about half of what was cut during the recession. If you recall, the legislature cut over $80 million in TANF during the recession, agreed to leave the grant level there, but cut a lot of the job services and the other support services that would help families move forward, primarily because there weren't any jobs for them at that point. So now that that's changing, we really need to reinvest in those things that will help families move forward. I want to urge you to fully fund the $40 million in additional requests. I realize that may be a little bit difficult with the budget that you got from the co-chairs, so we would also encourage you to push hard against that to fully fund all of the programs that are going to help these families move forward. And part of the reason we feel that is because we know that no matter how much money is invested in education, if a child is hungry or does not have a roof over their heads, they're not going to be able to learn, no matter how quality the education is. So we've got to have these families stable and the kids ready to learn in school. So I ask for your full support for these programs. Thank you very much.
Questions? Are you suggesting we take a look at K-12 funding?
Either that or that.
Please introduce yourself to the committee.
Wonderful. Good morning. Good morning, Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Roland-Schwartz. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. We are a statewide nonprofit with multidisciplinary membership, and our mission is to facilitate a victim-centered approach to the prevention of and response to sexual assault in Oregon. I'm happy to be here to testify in support of House Bill 5026, ensuring self-sufficiency funding under Department of Human Services, and specifically the Temporary Assistance to Domestic Violence Survivors Program, or TADVS. The task force recently testified in support of Senate Bill 503, which would expand TADVS funds to include survivors of sexual assault, and Sybil Hebb testified to that moments ago. The TADVS program currently provides critical assistance to domestic violence survivors with children who need to flee violence. Access to emergency funds allows victims the ability to put safety measures in place, increasing their short-term and long-term stabilities. And when survivors have safety measures in place, they are more likely to address the immediate legal and medical needs following a sexual assault, and are more likely to engage in support services that mitigate the trauma that they've experienced and allow them to better protect their children. The program has worked well to help many victims of domestic violence and their children escape abuse, and we urge expanded funding so that the program can help more victims in need. Specifically, we hope that the program can be expanded to include sexual assault survivors. Sexual assault often occurs in or near the victim's home, in the homes of family, friends, and acquaintances, and perpetrators are often known to the victim. They may be intimate or non-intimate relationship. As a result, home may not be a safe place. So access to emergency transportation, shelter, lock changes, security locks, and other emergency expenses provide victims with a strong foundation for healing. And barriers to emergency funds and provisions only serve to compound the emotional trauma that victims experience following a sexual assault. As a consequence, and we have the opportunity to prevent that consequence if we expand those services to survivors of sexual assault. Passing House Bill 5026 and ultimately increasing funding to extend TADVS services to victims of assault will positively impact the immediate and long-term safety of victims and children in their care. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony, and I'm available for any further questions.
Thank you. Questions?
I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give us a rough estimate of how many people this might add? Is it about a third more than the DV victims already that would be experiencing sexual assault and not being counted in the DV numbers?
Sure. Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, and Representative Kinney-Geyer. My understanding is that there are others that here today that have a better sense of what the increase in percentage would be, and so I would actually defer to them if I may. Thank you.
I have a quick question for you, too. Certain counties in our state are under really deep financial stress.
Yes.
We recently had an issue in Josephine County where a woman called in, and she was a victim of sexual assault, and there was no one available to go from public safety to deal with that.
Right.
How much are you seeing of that across the state now also?
Right. Senator Bates, thank you. That's a very good question. I think that Josephine County is a unfortunate example of not having those emergency provisions in place. I'm grateful that we have community-based domestic violence and sexual assault services throughout the state that are able to come forward and help victims put safety measures in place. But this is an example of a community where there are not necessarily public safety services available 24/7, and so having access to critical emergency provisions immediately following a domestic violence or sexual assault case will prove to mitigate the trauma and reduce the safety issues that victims are experiencing.
Is your program active in Josephine County right now?
Our program, we are a multidisciplinary statewide nonprofit. We provide training and technical assistance, and our membership is multidisciplinary and has representation statewide. So we work closely with programs in counties all across Oregon, including Josephine County.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
Just a quick question. Have the trends changed in the number of assaults across the state since we're beginning to see some economic recovery? Because, you know, generally, you know, just some assumptions is that when the economy's bad, you know, several things happen. The assault and the abuse rates go up. You know, whether we're talking child abuse or whether we're talking domestic violence, there tends to be that correlation. And then the alcohol and drug consumption is also plays a part in all this. So what trends are we seeing?
Senator Winters, thank you for that question. The Sexual Assault Task Force is specifically focused on adult and adolescent sexual assault, and so domestic violence is not necessarily our bailiwick, and so I would defer to some of the experts in the room. But I would say that when there are options available to survivors, when they have access to resources to be able to put safety measures in place for themselves and their children, they are more likely to come forward and access those services. And so, you know, you may see an increase in reporting as a result of that and women and children accessing critical services. And so I don't want to speculate on reporting rates when I think that there are a number of factors that are involved.
Now, is there a repository of this kind of information, both on domestic and sexual assaults? Which agency or agency is responsible for the collection of that data and trend lines?
Senator Winters, I wish that I had an answer to that question. I would actually need to defer to some of the other folks in the room.
It's actually an excellent question. Yeah. We may be entering a new situation where drug and alcohol problems and mental health problems, which are being improperly taken care of, may be a separate factor now. It may not be a financial situation anymore. And we've got an epidemic of drug and alcohol problems out there, as well as mental health that are not being met. So I think the question is very germane. We should get those numbers.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Thank you for the question.
Thank you.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa, and I'm the strategic director for Children First for Oregon, where our mission is to make long-term systemic changes through policies and programs that strengthen families and help keep kids healthy and safe. For those of you who are familiar with public safety, you know that at no time are victims more vulnerable and more at risk than they are when they choose to leave an abusive home. Before you, I have two concepts that Sybil referenced earlier that can be literal lifesavers for these families. The temporary assistance for domestic violence survivors allows for low-income victims to access one-time emergency assistance. I think that's one thing that hasn't been mentioned yet. This is a one-time amount of up to $1,200. Access to this program makes it more likely that kids will remain safe from abuse. This amount hasn't been raised since 1996. And as we talk a lot about COLAs in this building, Children First urges you to put that amount into real $2015 dollars. Secondly, in 2013, there were about 12,000 calls for emergency housing assistance that were unable to be met. Interestingly, there's about that number, a little over 12,200 kids in care in Oregon annually. It just makes sense. When one-third of the child welfare caseload is a reflection of domestic violence, that there are co-located services to have domestic violence advocates in the DHS offices where victims can access them immediately, where they can have on-site access to safety planning, to learn about domestic violence and what happens and what services are available to them, and to learn about self-sufficiency. These services can lead to less time in foster care, and we know that there is a direct correlation between domestic abuse and child fatalities. As advocates for kids' safety, their health, their economic security, Children First strongly endorses coordinating domestic violence experts and caseworkers in one place, and we ask that this program be fully funded across the state so that this can be used in every county. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions?
Representative Boone. A question for Michelle. I was going to say Melanie. And thank you for what you guys do. What worries me is something that Senator Bates alluded to, and that is in the rural areas, and especially those with little or no law enforcement available readily, and if it is available in some areas, it's a good hour away, if that's. A person who's been the victim of an assault of any kind, sexual or other, and the perpetrator's outside the house, you may have, you know, you can't change a lock that fast, and things like that. Is there any avenue for getting that person out of the house?
Right.
In case, because you can't keep them safe in that sense, in that place.
Representative Boone, thank you so much for your question. I think that in cases where, you know, the example of Josephine County, where there is not a high level of law enforcement presence, having access to the community-based programs and services is critical. Being able to connect with the crisis services, the local domestic violence sexual assault program. I believe Women's Crisis Support Team is the local program. And being able to connect with them and conduct safety planning, that's what the organizations are really there for, to be able to help victims after a sexual assault put measures of safety in place for themselves. And so, you know, if they have access to a motel voucher that they could, you know, go with their child for the evening, and then again continue to make those plans to have the lock changes and put those measures of safety in place, I think it's critical. I agree that having other avenues to resources, law enforcement resources, as a means to put those safety measures in place is also critical. But again, having access to the service providers in their community is the most appropriate way for them to really map out and plan what those safety measures would look like.
Follow up.
We're gonna run out of time, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to comment on that. That's great if you live in a city and there's a lot of resource and you can move from point A to point B quickly, but I'm talking about out in the rural areas. Planning's great for afterwards. You need to get that person safe now. And do you co-op with what law enforcement there is in areas, or do you have some sort of way to get these victims out of the area of their perpetrator?
I agree with you. I think that the reality in some of our rural and frontier regions is certainly dire, and so being able to support those community-based programs to plan long-term.
You're not answering my question.
I'm sorry.
I think what she's trying to get to is this.
Yeah.
If a call comes in on 911 and somebody's in trouble, you don't have anybody go out to that home, pick that woman up, because Julie is, and get them out there. That's a problem for public safety people,
right,
not for you. The answer is, no, we don't have that. And I don't want this to go on forever, because you don't. That's not your role. You don't have
it.
Right. We wish you did. It's a huge problem.
I agree.
Huge problem. You're not going to be able to help somebody who's dead. Okay? All right? So it's a huge problem, one we're going to have to deal with.
And Mr. Chair, just since the subject was brought up, during the last session, your public safety subcommittee did provide extra dollars to Josephine County in the way of state trooper backup. We cannot we can't override the fact that the citizens did not actually pass their tax levy.
That's right.
That's the same that existed in my county and Polk County. So, I mean, you have a system of where you've got a local jurisdiction that are responsible for certain aspects, and so I need to put that on record because individuals listen to our conversation and they may think this is all a state issue and you've got these other governmental jurisdictions that are already also involved.
I would tell people sitting in front of us, you can tell us no. No, I don't do that.
You don't.
I wish I could, but no, I don't do that. Don't beat around the bush. We can.
Right.
We're mainly adults up here. The other ones are at least.
Thank
I
you.
May not be. Marie Hill, Heather Conroy, and Philip Kennedy Wong. And then on deck, I'm going to get this wrong, Elizabeth Kushwa, Jenna Bauer.
She just
said
it.
Oh, I get those names mixed up already. We're here, right? Oh, they brought up. So, Jenna, I'll remember it to them. Introduce yourself to the committee.
Great. Co-Chairs Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, I'm Heather Conroy, and I'm the Executive Director of SEIU Local 503. We represent 55,000 workers across the state of Oregon, including folks that work for state and local governments, nonprofits, home care, adult foster care, and child care providers. SEIU 503 represents license-exempt family, friends, and neighbor, or FFN, child care providers. Low-income families in Oregon who are making at or below 185% of the federal poverty level can be eligible for employment-related daycare. That program, also known as ERDC, provides families with a subsidy to help pay for child care, and the families themselves also pay a copay in addition to the subsidy they receive. The high cost of the child care in our state make it unaffordable for many families that are already struggling to make ends meet. In Oregon, it's true that we actually rank last in the nation for affordable child care. The ERDC program helps low-income families enter and stay in the workforce while providing high-quality, safe, and reliable child care options for their families. As the economy has recovered, many folks are going back to work, but they're going back to work part-time with irregular schedules and not traditional full-time, 9-to-5 kind of work. The work that our child care providers do in the Family, Friends, and Neighbor program are the exact providers who can meet the needs of those parents returning to the workforce in irregular part-time work, who really a child care center that's open from 8 to 6 is just not going to work for those families. Many folks don't realize this, but currently the license-exempt child care providers, who are predominantly women, get paid anywhere from $2.20 to $3 per child per hour. And this is based on a pretty complex formula that takes into account geography, the age of the child, and the market for child care in the area. So license-exempt providers that we represent can only take care of 3 children at any given time. And what that means is that a child care provider providing for 3 kids doesn't even make Oregon's minimum wage. So we believe if a provider is caring for 3 children at any given hour, they should make at least the minimum wage in Oregon. Child care providers in the ERDC program support Oregon families at a time when they need it most. So let's give them the respect that they deserve and at least pay them a minimum wage. Speaker Kotek has proposed a $60 million investment in ERDC that would strengthen and expand the program, support working families struggling to make ends meet, and we think this investment is vital in supporting Oregon families. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Co-Chair Bates and Co-Chair Nathanson, my name is Marie Hill, and I'm an eligibility worker with the Department of Human Services Self-Sufficiency, and I'm also a member of the SEIU Local 503. I work with clients that are applying for ERDC and SNAP benefits. I help determine benefit amounts, including food benefits, co-pays for ERDC, and child care hours. Specifically, my branch handles all of the ERDC cases in District 2, which is comprised of Multnomah County. There are many important aspects to my job. One of the most important parts of my work is that we are helping people become and sustain self-sufficiency. By providing a subsidy for quality child care, parents are able to join and stay in the workforce. Oregon has one of the highest costs of child care in the country. Helping families with child care has a positive ripple effect throughout their life. The ERDC program helps struggling families by providing some stability in their life. The families who benefit from the ERDC system rely on it not only for help financially, but also to ensure their children are receiving quality child care that they may not have access to otherwise. It is one less thing for these families to worry about. The child care providers that care for families in the ERDC program are a vital part of this system. Currently, even when these workers care for the maximum number of children they're allowed to, many of them make less than minimum wage. This has to change. These workers provide stability and support for vulnerable families. They shouldn't have to worry about how to pay their bills or buy groceries each month. Speaker Kotek has proposed a $60 million investment in ERDC that will strengthen and expand the program. Every day I see how this program helps families. There is a huge need that is not currently being met. It is vital that you pass House Bill 2015 and expand the number of slots available to Oregon families. ERDC has a limit to the number of families it can serve. When the program reaches its limit, a waitlist is started. Families are placed on the waitlist unless they meet an exemption criteria. The current waitlist started in October 2014, has 1,900 families on it. This represents 3,420 children as of 2 weeks ago. An average of 420 families are added every month. Please support the ERDC program by passing House Bill 2015 and the full investment package, and by paying child care providers at least minimum wage. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Chair Bates and Chair Nathanson, for the record, Philip Kennedy Wong, representing Oregon Food Bank. I'm here to support a reinvestment of $30 million in the TANF program, plus an additional $10 million. And before I go into detail, I want to take this opportunity to give you the connection that Oregon Food Bank Network has to the TANF program. As you know, TANF is required to provide what's called a TANF maintenance of effort to the federal government in order to get its block grant. And so every year, roughly, the state has to expend $98.7 million to receive its $166.8 million per year from the TANF block grant. One of the things the Oregon Food Bank Network has done, because we do serve a lot of clients that are eligible for the program, has allowed the state to count what's called third-party TANF MOE. And so for the last several years, we have contributed to the state's requirement to the tune of, and I'll say in consecutive years, of 2013 and 14, $17.3 million and $23.7 million. So that's a good chunk of the TANF MOE that the Oregon Food Bank Network is contributing. And that comes in the value of the food that we acquire and the volunteer hours as translated, you know, as what it would actually cost if we paid those volunteers. So having said all of that, I do want to spend the remaining part of my time to talk about something that was brought up in the TANF Alliance. You should have before you, from one of my earlier colleagues, four areas that we would like to see the $10 million invested in. I want to talk about the importance of having a study of clients who leave the TANF program. One of the challenges, obviously, for clients when they leave the program is the kind of job that they get. Are they the kind of jobs that will be, you know, providing the types of wages where they can support themselves and their families? And I will say that based on our studies, when you take a look at what is needed, say, for a single parent and adult, you need to make roughly $40,000 a year. If you're a single parent with two kids, $49,000 a year. So chances are the first job that a client will take exiting TANF will most likely be a low wage or entry level type jobs. And I think with the study we can talk and we can take a strong closer look at how we can transition clients into more career oriented type jobs and how support services in TANF can allow clients to be able to get the kind of vocational training they need to move on into higher paying jobs. The last thing I want to state is, and I'm not sure when this committee will discuss it, but there will be some food programs that are transitioning from the Housing and Community Services Agency to DHS, and I do want to mention that just to make sure that's on your radar. The Oregon Hunger Response Fund, which is a fund that's coming out of Housing and Community Services, is being moved over into DHS for the next biennium. We want to put that on your radar. It's a program that the food banks rely on, and we are requesting $3.25 million for the Hunger Response Fund, and we hope to have a time time in the future to talk further about it.
Thank you all for your testimony. Thank you for taking time to meet with us today. Thank you very much. Alex Kuehler and Janet Bauer. I can't read the handwriting. This is
okay.
Specific. What is this one?
It's pronounced Kyler. Okay. You can't tell from the spelling.
No, you can't. You're right. I'm just telling you.
Alex, I apologize for butchering your name.
Oh, that's
fine. I'm sure he's used to it.
Okay. Mine is
Tyler,
bad.
No worries. You. We'll get it one of these years. Senator Bates, Representative Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, I am Alex Kuehler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. And I hope to bring just a new perspective to the testimony today, and that's to speak about the potential for youth who are involved in both the child welfare system and the juvenile justice system. This is a we're targeting in Lane County youth age 11 to 14 who are often residents of foster care or who live in a dysfunctional home, and we know that these youth are at an extremely high risk for future involvement with the juvenile justice system. The youth come to the attention of the Lane County Youth Services Division, the Oregon Department of Human Services Child Welfare Division, or through a variety of local mental health service providers. We've learned that if we're able to respond quickly to these youth's needs, we minimize their progression into and through both the child welfare and juvenile justice system. Lane County Youth Services and DHS Child Welfare were chosen to participate in a technical assistance program related to dual system involved youth called the Crossover Youth Practice Model, and it's conducted by Georgetown University Center for Juvenile Justice Reform. This new way of doing things has sparked the conversation about identifying gaps in our continuum of service delivery and strategies for more engaged service delivery that meets the needs of youth and families involved in both systems. And as a result of those conversations, we identified the need for a youth shelter and assessment project. And I want to note for the committee that there is not such a service available to the youth in Lane County currently. In talking to the child welfare folks, there's over 40 kids from Lane County who are actually placed out of county right now. Last week, if they had had an assessment center available, there would have been 6 youth that they could have placed into such a center. We're talking about respite for short-term sort of families that are about to blow up, or for longer care treatment services that get wrapped around. And given your previous conversation, actually some of those youth are transported down to Josephine County. Some actually go north. And so the conversation we're having is really reminiscent, I think, of some of the government efficiency stuff that Representative Nathanson has been such a champion for in the past, about how can we work with the agency to identify potential cost savings. We don't have this all worked out yet. We do have a facility that we've identified. We are working with a potential contractor. Looking Glass is a nonprofit provider in Lane County who's been involved with us before. They're in a sort of the initial sort of awkward phase of trying to determine their actual cost prior to there being a contract. And I wanted to bring this opportunity to the attention of the committee and just thank the staff at Child Welfare for working with us as we try to solve this issue and provide better services in Lane County.
Thank you. Comment?
I actually be sort of interested in Representative Stark's perspective on this as well, having been a foster parent for a brief period of my life. I don't know what your sense is, Mr. Kuehler, in Lane County, and I absolutely am not trying to pound on child welfare, but I find that not just from my experience, but from other foster parents I've spoken with, that the level of training and support that foster parents get, especially with kids, as many of these kids do, because you have difficulties, is sort of limited. And I wonder if you have a sense of whether that's part of the issue in Lane County or whether this is related to other reasons. I mean, I just am a little unsure. And I think some parents, frankly, are also concerned about liability related to this.
Co-Chairs Bates, Nathanson, and Senator Steiner Hayward, I think even some of the testimony you heard very early this morning and some of the situations that we've used to describe the kind of youth who are potentially suited or, you know, that we need to provide services for, the environments that they're in, they encounter other youth in foster homes that may be confrontational. They get placed onto the streets in some cases for their, because they feel like they have to run from those kinds of situations. It just sets up this sort of path that gets them into that juvenile justice system. And I think that this all goes back to a lot of the work we're doing on adverse childhood experiences, the work with runaway youth around 15th night and trying to make sure that kids are off the streets prior to them being deeper and deeper into that situation. We're trying to work in Lane County further and further upstream to make sure that kids don't enter that, especially that public safety system. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but what I've been told is that the service that we're proposing will provide not only services for the youth themselves, but also for parents, so that there is some degree of ability to bring skills up from both the youth for, you know, self-management and also the parents for helping with those children in their care.
Okay, thank you.
Alex, are you aware of a program in Jackson County called Hearts with a Mission?
I am not.
I'll talk to you about it. That's what you're trying to set up. It's already been done there through a nonprofit. They're taking kids off the street, stabilize them, and work with their families to see if they can reunify them. But they can't always. These are mainly kids 14 to about 18. Right. Is that the age group you're looking at?
We're talking about kids 11 to 14.
Okay, so that's entire slice. Okay, yeah. Thanks.
I would encourage the committee, if I might, that the Georgetown University crossover youth practice model is an interesting read on the internet. There are four counties in Oregon that are involved with this to identify those particular youth.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. It's also being discussed in a different committee right now, too. Okay. Yes.
Good morning, Senator Bates. Co-chairs Bates and Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer, and I'm a policy analyst at the Oregon Center for Public Policy. OCPP participates in the TANF Alliance, and I'm here today to talk about the DHS budget, their request for funds to continue the TANF program, and also in support of the TANF Alliance's request for additional $10 million to further strengthen the program. I want to thank you for your work in deliberating around choices on the budget. I know, and I also want to appreciate your concern about addressing poverty in Oregon. As we know, there are far too many children in Oregon who live in poverty, which is a risk factor for many issues that we deal with here at the state level. The latest count for children in poverty is 180,000 children. These levels are unprecedented. The TANF program serves a small portion of children in poverty, just 52 or 53,000 we currently support through cash assistance and employment services to their families. The reason why we can provide supports for so few children in Oregon is in part because of the income eligibility limit that our program has. And that limit has been stuck for nearly a quarter century. A family of three can make no more than $616 a month and get assistance. In the past, that, well, first of all, that's just about 37% of poverty. And in the past, we've been able to support more working families. So we are supportive of the agency's intention to invest in increasing the income limit for participants in the program. We would like to see that go further and increase the income limit for applicants to the program, meaning a person could work more than 2 days a week and get assistance. I also want to express support for the study. We invest a lot of money into the in the TANF program, and we need to have a better handle on what outcomes we're getting. The study that's been indicated by the TANF Alliance for Investment would help get us that information. I want to thank you so much for the opportunity to testify, and thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yeah.
Representative Stark, I think you wanted to speak to...
Yes, Chair Bates, I was going to respond to Senator Steiner Hayward there on just the amount of training, in a sense, that a foster parent receives. In my experience, and we've gone through the certification a number of times, and again, my wife has worked for DHS as a caseworker, so we know it fairly well. When it comes to the average child, I've felt like there's an abundance of training and support available. However, if you don't tap into the supports right away within the first month or two of being a foster parent, it's easy to forget that those exist. Because, and you get monthly newsletters on all the different trainings available. And so for the percentage of people who tap into that, you have an abundance of, but for the higher risk, higher challenge children, there's little that coaches you on how to do that. And I've seen some comparisons. I've worked in residential treatment with at-risk youth. And when you look at collaborative problem-solving training that some of the agencies are beginning to do, even, you know, OIS, you know, as far as averting and restraint training, foster parents wouldn't restrain, but aversion of physical harm and so forth, those are trainings I think we could easily implement into the everyday foster training setting and equip parents a lot better. And the training's out there, and it's available, and it's wouldn't be difficult to access that and connect the two, but I've yet to see those connect.
Thank you, Representative.
So we finished our testimony this morning. Is anyone else in the room, especially any of the young people, like to come up and get testimony?
Not you, Tamara.
I'm not going to touch that one. I get myself in trouble, Tamara. All right, thank you all.
Mr. Co-Chair, tomorrow, yes, on your agenda, the first thing on the agenda tomorrow is a public hearing and work session on the hospital assessment bill. The extension of the hospital assessment relates directly to the Oregon Health Authority budget. Is that ringing a bell, Senator Bates?
Yeah, I was thinking it was going to be, we got to get to full on Friday.
Yes, so it's, yeah. So that's the first item on the agenda tomorrow, and then we're going to have Ms. Kelly Seal back tomorrow to kind of wrap up or sort of summarize the first chunk of program work we did with the department, but this is only kind of the first phase of the work that we're doing with the agency and committee.
Thank you. Seeing no more questions, thank you for attending, and we are adjourned.
You're way more paranoid than I am.
Ending, and we are adjourned.
You're way more paranoid than I am.